There's a calm surrender to the rush of day. When the heat of a rolling wave can't be turned away, an enchanted moment.
Greetings, everybody, and welcome. I'm so happy to be here with you tonight. And especially on this last day of 2014, I will be very happy to put this year to bed. I think it was maybe the worst year I can remember in many years, if not ever. I really had it with 2014 because there were so many delays. It was very difficult. I was ill a lot of this year because physically it was hard to handle the pressure of all the developments with disclosure. And now that we're this close again, things have simmered down, and I know 2015 will be our best year ever. So happy new year in the morning, everybody. I have a very special treat for you tonight. I'm going to share with you my very favorite interview ever. I get teared up every time I watch this one. It's about disclosure, and it's the best thing I've ever presented to you. I'm going to hold that off for a little while, but I just want to say stay tuned. It's an hour and 20 minutes, so I'm going to talk for a little while, and then we'll end with it. To launch us off tonight, I wanted to just play a special interview that I have. This is only 5 minutes, but I thought it was appropriate for the new year to set us in the right. This is Gandhi, and he's speaking about divine government, and his civil rights movement was no different than the disclosure movement. And he's talking in this interview about divine government and why our earthly governments have to be responsible to God. It's very good. Enjoy this. I'll be right back. Okay, sorry. I had that queued up with no volume. I hate when that happens. All right, everybody. Enjoy this.
Indefinable, mysterious power that pervades everything. I feel it, though I do not see it. It is this unseen power which makes itself felt and yet defies all proof, because it is so unlike all that I perceive through my senses. It transcends the senses, but it is possible to reason out the existence of God to a limited extent. Even in ordinary affairs, we know that people do not know who rules or why and how he rules. And yet they know that there is a power that certainly rules. In my tour last year in Mysore, I met many poor villagers, and I found upon inquiry that they did not know who ruled Mysore. They simply said, some god ruled it. If the knowledge of these poor people was so limited about their ruler, I, who am infinitely lesser in respect to God than they to their ruler, need not be surprised if I do not realize the presence of God, the King of Kings. Nevertheless, I do feel, as the poor villagers felt about Mysore, that there is orderliness in the universe. There is an unalterable law governing everything and every being that exists or lives. It is not a blind law, for no blind law can govern the conduct of living beings. And thanks to the marvelous researches of Sir J.C. Bose, it can now be proved that even matter is life. That law, then, which governs all life is God. Law and the lawgiver are one. I may not deny the law or the lawgiver because I know so little about it or him. Just as my denial or ignorance of the existence of an earthly power will avail me nothing, even so my denial of God and his law will not liberate me from its operation. Whereas humble and mute acceptance of divine authority makes life's journey easier, even as the acceptance of earthly rule makes life under it easier. I do dimly perceive that whilst everything around me is ever changing, ever dying, there is underlying all that change a living power that is changeless, that holds all together, that creates, dissolves, and recreates. That informing power or spirit is God, and since nothing else that I see merely through the senses can or will persist, he alone is. And is this power benevolent or malevolent? I see it as purely benevolent, for I can see that in the midst of death, life persists. In the midst of untruth, truth persists. In the midst of darkness, light persists. Hence I gather that God is life, truth, light. He is love. He is the supreme good. But he is no God who merely satisfies the intellect, if he ever does. God, to be God, must rule the heart and transform it. He must express himself in every smallest act of his votary. This can only be done through a definite realization, more real than the five senses can ever produce. Sense perceptions can be and often are false and deceptive, however real they may appear to us. Where there is realization outside the senses, it is infallible. It is proved not by extraneous evidence, but in the transformed conduct and character of those who have felt the real presence of God within. Such testimony is to be found in the experiences of an unbroken line of prophets and sages in all countries and climes. To reject this evidence is to deny oneself. This realization is preceded by an immovable faith. He who would, in his own person, test the fact of God's presence can do so by a living faith. And since faith itself cannot be proved by extraneous evidence, the safest course is to believe in the moral government of the world, and therefore in the supremacy of the moral law, the law of truth and love. Exercise of faith will be the safest where there is a clear determination, summarily, to reject all that is contrary to truth and love. I confess that I have no argument to convince through reason. Faith transcends reason. All I can advise is not to attempt the impossible.
He says faith transcends reason. Certainly makes sense to me. I'm not sure I know any other way to be. So, just as an update on the Congressional Hearings Initiative, for our tweet storm, as of the 29th of December, we had 687,127 tweets gone out to Congress. That is amazing, excellent work. Congratulations, everybody. Great job. And I'd like to just share some posts that I wrote this week, trying to flip through and choose the best ones. These are just kind of little snippets of posts that I posted this week about the Congressional Hearings Initiative. There was an article about Edward Snowden and Laura Petraeus and others being sued for billions of dollars. And the article's wondering why, you know, they're considered outlaws and why they aren't heroes. So my comment was, we need the help of journalists to end the truth embargo. And the U.S. government is well aware. As things are in the pre-disclosure world, journalists must flee to foreign safe havens in order to report the truth. We must work hard on the White House petition starting January 7th to gather 100,000 signatures to bring forth the truth about extraterrestrials engaging the human race. That issue reveals truths hidden in the intelligence community around the world. It also effectively ends a need for a standing military. It returns the black budget money to we the people. It frees science technology, suppressed patents, and makes available free energy, which in turn cleans up the environment. Navy veteran and Foreign Secretary of Transportation for the state of Kansas is suing Edward Snowden, Laura Petraeus, and a handful of Hollywood defendants for profiteering from the distribution of stolen documents. There was also a story this week that 60 journalists have been killed this year. And so we have to really recognize how important their work is, because the media is the only one who can bring to the general populace the information about disclosure. Sure, a few of us know about it, but we need everyone to become aware of it. And the only way for that to happen is television interviews and articles by investigative reporters who are digging to find the truth. I also wrote this post. It is not easy for folks to comprehend the enormity of the truth embargo and the importance of why we must work hard to end it. The intelligence community responsible for holding the truth embargo in place 67 years falls under the direct orders of the Department of Defense at the head. That statement is true, except not the FBI. The FBI is under the Justice Department, and that brings in the Supreme Court. So it not only brings in the Supreme Court, it brings in the State Department, it brings in the Treasury, and it brings in the Department of Energy. They're all implicated. NSA and every other one I'm about to list is under Department of Defense. If that tells you anything, that should be a wake-up call. The National Security Act outlines this fact and was enacted in 1947, the same year as the Roswell crash, the beginning of the truth embargo. The Pentagon. Those responsible for disclosure, they include and are not limited to. Now understand what I'm saying here. Because these all fall under the Department of Defense, they're all included under that umbrella of the Department of Defense. All of these intelligence agencies I'm about to list come under the Department of Defense, so let's not have any confusion when we say the Pentagon and the President are the only two involved in disclosure. That's absolutely true, but understand how many that represents. They include and are not limited to. I'm reading this from an executive order that outlines this explanation. Intelligence community and agencies within the intelligence community refer to the following agencies or organizations. Number one, the Central Intelligence Agency, CIA. Number two, the National Security Agency, NSA. Number three, the Defense Intelligence Agency, DIA. Number four, the offices within the Department of Defense for the collection of specialized national foreign intelligence through reconnaissance programs. Understand that the Allies who began the truth embargo in 1947 with the United States are part of this intelligence reconnaissance that is a national foreign intelligence. So not only the United States is implicated, this is an international exopolitical movement. Number five, the Bureau of Intelligence and Research of the Department of State. The State Department's implicated. Number six, the intelligence elements of the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps. That's nothing small, because Army has its own intelligence, Navy has its own intelligence, Air Force, Marine, they're all spread out all over the earth. So they're gathering intelligence for foreign entities. The Federal Bureau of Investigation, the Department of Treasury, and the Department of Energy, and the staff elements of the Director of Central Intelligence. The National Foreign Intelligence Program includes the programs listed below, but its composition shall be subject to review by the National Security Council and modification by the President. The programs of the CIA, number one. Number two, the Consolidated Cryptologic Program, the General Defense Intelligence Program, and the programs of the offices within the Department of Defense for the collection of specialized national foreign intelligence through reconnaissance, except such elements as the Director of Central Intelligence and the Security of Defense agree should be excluded. Number three, other programs of agencies within the intelligence community designated jointly by the Director of Central Intelligence and the head of the department or by the President as national foreign intelligence or counterintelligence activity. Number four, activities of the staff elements of the Director of Central Intelligence. And number five, activities to acquire the intelligence required for the planning and conduct of tactical operations by the United States military forces. They are not included in the National Foreign Intelligence. That comes from Executive Order Number 123333. And illegal surveillance is directly related to the truth embargo. It is time for a formal disclosure from the Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces, heading up DOD and responsible for the intelligence community, which is massive. And here, with our allies, continuing the truth embargo, this is an international issue, and the Congressional Hearings Initiative, a project of Paradigm Research Group, is an international exopolitical movement. And the White House petition, which begins January 7th, may be signed by any country. Only your initials and email are required. In order to establish an account so you can sign the petition, you can go to petitions.whitehouse.gov. And either log in if you've already signed a petition, or and check and make sure that your password is up to date, or else create an account. On Christmas Eve Day, on 2014, 12 years of reports from the NSA were dumped, and they hoped no one would notice. Wake up, everybody. Those agencies I just listed off, that's a mouthful. All of those agencies fall under Department of Defense, except for FBI, like I said. So, in order to grasp the enormity of the truth embargo and the secret space program, you have to take that into consideration. That's what we're working to end here. I think it's a noble cause. I think it's worth our time. And I hope you'll all stick in there and help me out. January is going to be the most busy month of the Congressional Hearings Initiative. And we have a lot of work to do. Another post that I shared this week was, I said, this is really harsh. I never knew this before. And folks were commenting that they weren't aware of this either. This is an article from tellusyourtv.net. I say in my post, where do you think the secret space program siphons its budget from? $337 million a day for the last 13 years. And that was for the Afghanistan and Iraq wars. Ending the truth embargo will launch a new age of reformation in every area of humanity's existence. When we have a formal disclosure, there will be world peace. Do you see the connections? The U.S. government has spent $1.6 trillion on war since 9/11. According to a recent report by the Congressional Research Services, this means U.S. taxpayers have shelled out roughly $337 million a day over the last 13 years. Can you imagine what we could be spending that on if we had that money back? It's staggering, really. I'm flipping through to see my article is missing from my timeline and also the Disclosure Lobby. I know people complain that they have missing articles and it doesn't really happen to me, but now I don't see them. Let's see. Here it is. There is an unalterable law governing everything, every being, including extraterrestrials, that exists or lives. That law which governs all life is God. Law and the lawgiver are one. In the midst of death, life persists. In the midst of truth, truth persists. In the midst of darkness, light persists. The safest course is to believe in the modern government of the world and therefore in the supremacy of the modern law. The law of truth and love. Exercise of this will be the safest, where there will be a pure determination, similarly to reject all that is contrary to truth and love. Mahatma Gandhi, 17th October 1931. That was part of a quote from that video that I played in the beginning. Through decades of truth embargo, decades of refusing to vote or take responsibility as a voting member of a democracy, decades of lethargy, we are well on our way to a police state. It is our responsibility as members of Earth's civilization to be accountable for the actions of the country we belong. There are tools in place within our democracy to accomplish change. One tool is to petition our government for change. The United States, along with our allies from the 1940s, agreed to a truth embargo. The United States, her citizens, and the citizens of her allies are most responsible to clean up the mess. President Obama is the disclosure president. We open the door for him to do his duty as Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces of the United States, working with the Pentagon. And remember, that means all those intelligence agencies, to disclose the extraterrestrial presence engaging the human race after we hold congressional hearings on the extraterrestrial issue with scores of high-ranking military agency and political witnesses coming forward under oath. You have a choice today. You may reflect on the importance of this issue within the context of the declining health of our world society. You may choose to understand the importance of action politics. In doing so, you may just decide to spread the word by sharing this post. You may even go to the lengths of registering on the White House website and deciding to come back on January 7th when it is posted to sign House petition supporting a congressional hearing on the extraterrestrial issue. All may sign. The Central Intelligence Agency was originally constructed to deal with the extraterrestrial issue. They are able to hide their illegal and immoral activities in no small part because of the truth embargo. A formal disclosure, which is not in the hands of Congress or the cabal, but rather in the hands of the President, the Pentagon, we the people, and the media, is the only hope for launching a new age of reformation in every area of our world society. Times have changed. Abuses committed by the intelligent community go much, much deeper than torture. Unfortunately, those abuses go unknown due to the continuation of the embargo. Known or unknown, we are held by the unalterable law governing everything to end the abuses. Will you sign the White House petition supporting congressional hearings designed to end the truth embargo? 100,000 signatures will go a long way to attracting the attention of the media. They are and always have been our only target. Support the general populace of We the People in this country and abroad is what will change this. Now is the time to decide what side of history you will come down on. Disclosure is inevitable. Be the change. That's the final post that I wrote this week. So people have said to me, well, Beth, don't you think it's going to be really hard to get 100,000 signatures on that petition? And I say, no, not if everybody who's listening, who has a Facebook account, goes out and posts it in groups. Why are the groups important? Why did I start the Disclosure Lobby group? Because Facebook started a new policy, I don't know when, that news feed, when you post something on your timeline, it doesn't go to all your friends. So I have 5,000 friends, so a small percentage is seeing that. So maybe 200 people are seeing my posts at any given time. Unless they visit my timeline to see what's happening there. So when you have a group and you do a post, a notice goes out to all of the members of the group, and the Disclosure Lobby has something like 8,375 members right now. So 8,000 people see a post in my group. So if anything you want to post there, anybody can post on the Disclosure Lobby. I invite anybody to post there. We're keeping the posts about the politics of exopolitics, extraterrestrial phenomena, a rare occasional paranormal story. We're not doing channels there. We're not doing Ashtar there. We're keeping it strictly political. And this help educate. This group is to support the Congressional Hearings Initiative only. That's its only purpose. So it's to support those who don't have a great knowledge about extraterrestrial phenomena issues. And that's the reason I want to keep channelings and spiritual upliftment and ascension and Ashtar news off the Disclosure Lobby. It doesn't have a place there. That's for post-disclosure world. That will come later. So the disclosure petition number 6, the Congressional Hearings Petition by Paradigm Research Group, will go up on the White House website on January 7th. And on September 22nd of 2011, PRG petitioned the president to formally acknowledge an extraterrestrial presence engaging the human race. The White House response on November 4th, 2011, from the Office of Science and Technology stated, the U.S. government has no evidence of any life, that any life exists outside our planet, or that any extraterrestrial presence has contacted or engaged any member of the human race. In addition, there is no credible information to suggest that any evidence is being hidden from the public's eye. There are scores of government agency political witnesses of high rank and station prepared to testify under oath before congressional committees now about the evidence the White House states doesn't exist. So when people say to me, don't you think it will be hard to get 100,000 signatures? I say to them, well, listen, when we get 100,000 signatures, it forces the White House to put their position in writing about holding congressional hearings on the extraterrestrial issue. And no amount of effort anywhere can top that, because in 2011, Paradigm Research Group got the White House to put into writing their policy on the extraterrestrial issue for the first time in history. And that is landmark. We can go down in history for the rest of our lives, and that will be one of the most important events of the entire disclosure movement. Now, let's say Stephen Bassett is doing interviews on television because his publicist has lined up an interview with a really, you know, a nationally known late night talk show. He gets to go on there. And let's say we're only halfway through the petition. And he can say in his interview, hey, I've gotten 43,000 signatures so far. And we're only halfway done with the 30 days. That's going to have a lot of pull. That's going to impress the media. That's going to invoke the media to start writing about this story. And they are our target. So 100,000 or 43,000, the more we share and the more we ask anyone, excuse me, of like mind to just spend 2 minutes, if it's what they believe in, and put their initials down on that petition, it's going to mean so much, whether it's 43,000 or 100,000, whatever it ends up being, it's very important that we push. We have this one chance this month. This is it. This is our best chance of our lifetimes to have disclosure. I can't imagine anyone listening to me speaking right now who wants to spend their time hearing what I'm saying wouldn't go out there and at least get 10 other people. But if you're on Facebook, and you're posting to your groups, go out to your esoteric channeling, extraterrestrial, disclosure, and UFO groups and ask everybody to sign. And don't ask them once. Ask them again and again and again and again until we have 100,000 signatures. Because if we use Facebook groups as a tool, if we use it for how it's intended, it's an amazing gift that we have. And this is our one chance. So I hope each of you, especially if you haven't contributed the 686,000 tweets, and it's your turn to contribute, please help get those signatures done. Thank you, everybody. Hi, everybody. The most wonderful people at BBS Radio, they're always pure excellence. So sometimes there's power lines down or other things that are technical that have nothing to do with us. So the owners there, Don and Douglas, are the greatest and always standing by to do their best. Anyways, let's start this interview now. It's a speech. The very beginning of the speech is my favorite part. So even if we don't get to the end, it's okay. I know you'll enjoy this. Now you're hearing Ryan Wood, who's introducing Stephen Bassett, and he is co-founder of MajesticDocuments.com, and he and Dr. Robert Wood have been very helpful to me. Anyways, this is the Crash Retrieval Conference of 2004, and it's fabulous stuff. Enjoy it. This is my New Year's gift to you.
For tonight, who you heard moderate the panel last night, Mr. Stephen Bassett, is a wealth of information and dynamic activism. He's the founder of the Paradigm Research Group, the executive director of the Extraterrestrial Phenomenon Political Action Committee, pronounced XPAC, and the author of the Paradigm Clock website, a political columnist, commentator, and former independent candidate for Congress. I've wanted to sort of step aside and grill him about that. You know, how did it go, and how many votes did you get, and how much money did you raise? And that's right. So things like that, it'd be interesting. What was his, you know, final percentages? Presently, he's the only registered lobbyist in the United States representing extraterrestrial-related phenomena and research activity and organizations, and the first political action committee to target political implications of extraterrestrial-related phenomena. Since 1996, he has assisted a number of organizations and initiatives which have been making the case for, one, the end of government embargo on truth surrounding the extraterrestrial presence. That's the Stephen Greer work, I believe, and two, the open congressional hearings to make testimony of former military agency and employees and witnesses to extraterrestrial-related events and evidence. We've had Congress hearings before, and we need them again. They don't seem to hurt. They just sort of stir the pot again and again and raise the bar of denial and interaction. So I'm all for more congressional hearings, although skeptical that it will really occur. He has spoken to millions of Americans about
that
the
was
likelihood
in 2004. Now we know that's
event.
Not true anymore.
His speech tonight is called "Truth Retrieval: A Message for the President-Elect." Please help me welcome Mr. Stephen Bassett.
Be an exit poll. Welcome. Thank you so much for coming to this conference, supporting Bob and Ryan, and I'm glad to be here. It's always an honor to speak to people in this field who support the work of their researchers. And Ted's life work too, which is basically running around in a Hawaiian shirt and filming everything in sight. And he's really very good at it, by the way, and works incredibly hard. Before I start the keynote, I'd like to just maybe just say a few words about what I've been up to for about 6 months. Since about the middle of June, I've actually been traveling continuously throughout New Mexico, Virginia, Tennessee, California, Arizona, Colorado, speaking at a number of events, having meetings with individuals in the effort to get support necessary to pursue this work and do it right. And some progress has been made. And not what I would call breakthrough progress, but definitely some progress, getting closer and closer to a significant sea change in the movement, the political movement, which has been developing for some time. Along the way, I did complete a contract with the Hilton Hotel in Gaithersburg and signed up for the second annual X conference to be held April 22-24 outside of Washington, D.C. The first one was last year. I pledged to them all of my assets and inheritance and everything else ad infinitum, as well as my sister's, though I haven't told her that yet. And they agreed. And it's been redesigned, and the website is up, paradigmclock.com. That's the main portal. You go in. I'm going to try to get some flyers printed up tomorrow for those who don't have web access. And I hope that you'll be able to attend. I spoke at the NUFOC conference, which is the conference put on by Lisa Davis and John Miller in Hollywood. It went extremely well. And some contacts were made, I think, with some of the entertainment professionals there. I think you're going to see more of that. I think that conference is going to grow. It has unlimited potential, actually. The Hotel Renaissance, I think, though it can handle 2,000 people. But Hollywood is the other capital of the United States. Like it or not, it is, all right? And if you don't like what's going on in Washington, you should hang out there. If you don't like what's going on in Hollywood, you hang out in Washington. No problem. Yeah, both, right? And when you really need a break, you go to Kansas and you stay in a Motel 6. So hopefully we'll have this conference in April, and we'll proceed to move these issues forward. Now, we're going to cover some territory here tonight. Really, there's three parts to this keynote. I don't want to confuse you. It's just that it came out three parts. And I'm going to start with a wish, you know, that I have. Some of you may not understand this at first, but I'll try to explain.
What Steve is going to say next is the most important part of the Congressional Hearings Initiative. So pay attention. This is a part of history that you never hear. This speech is not on YouTube. It's nowhere to be found. It's Ryan Wood's property, and he mailed it to me a week ago because I wrote him and I said, "This is my favorite thing Steve ever said. And I can't live without it." So this is a pretty special sharing tonight. Listen up. You never heard this before.
I really wish that Dr. James E. McDonald, the nationally and I think internationally renowned atmospheric scientist, whose career trajectory ran from just after the war through about 1968, before things started to fall apart. And he was an extraordinary man who has an extraordinary place in the history of all this. And the reason that I wish he was here, where is Robert right now? I have the lights in my eyes. He's right there. Is because if he was at this conference today, he would be sitting right there next to Dr. Wood. He'd be 84 years old. He was he was 6 foot thin, athletic, didn't drink, didn't smoke, was in great shape. And I got a feeling he'd be just fine at 84 and just as acute of mind as Robert is today. And it would be appropriate because Dr. James McDonald.
You guys might remember Dr. Robert Wood. He was a witness at the Citizens Hearing on Disclosure in 2013. And he spoke about the Majestic documents.
I was a contemporary of Bob Wood's, a little older than he. And James was one of a group of absolute, solid, mainstream, first-rate scientists who in the period from after the war through 1971 looked at this issue exactly as the way it was supposed to be looked at within the context of who they were, where they were. If they were with a major engineering firm, they might examine it from that point of view because that was a little different time. James McDonald had it all. He had a brilliant mind, superb education. He married the love of his life, who he met while they were both serving in MIT in a military capacity. They had 6 children, all highly intelligent, went on to great colleges. They ended up in Arizona with a wonderful house, nice spread, fine salary, working at ASU. They had basically the perfect life. A life that we have come to appreciate more and more as we distance ourselves in time from that decade that we once used to joke about called the 1950s. A decade that's been ridiculed and made fun of. A perfect example was a movie, Pleasantville. You may have seen that movie. Right? The black and white 50s. But in retrospect, the 50s was far more important and powerful than I think we understand. And the reason, and I'll get back to the reason for that in just a second. The point is that this was the era of James McDonald. And he took on this issue with great vigor and intensity, right? And it destroyed him. And the way it destroyed him was quintessential Shakespearean, if you know what I'm saying. And if you've had some experience in Shakespeare, and some of you look like you went to school when you actually read Shakespeare. Now they just play the Shakespeare video game version, you know, Hamlet, you know, from hell, whatever they do. But Shakespearean tragedy is such that someone is brought down because they have what essentially is a perfectly human failing, which in the context of their life story is fatal. And in the case of James McDonald, it was classically. And what was his Shakespearean flaw? McDonald, like Robert and a number of other people in this room, was a pure scientist, the real deal. I'm not knocking scientists who are less pure. But what I mean by that is there are plenty of people that go to school and they get a science degree because they need a job. Need a job, right? It pays pretty well. So you study, you go out, you work for somebody, and you make money. Nothing wrong with that. In fact, that's what most of us do. However, we know that there is another person that gets into science, and they are in it for purely the science. That's it. All right. If it actually pays, that's a wonderful thing. And the characteristics of pure science is that is their life. It is their focus. Their reality revolves around the scientific process, which is an extraordinary thing. And that process has one very fundamental quality to it. It lives and dies on the integrity of information. Right? We have built a scientific understanding of this world and made it possible to operate computers like this on this that I have right here that I got on discount for $1,100 at Circuit City that could run the entire Apollo program, right, if I had it back then, okay, because of a process of the development of information with extreme integrity, growing it, expanding it, and encompassing a larger knowledge of the world. Seems pretty straightforward, doesn't it? That's what the scientist does. Through processes of great mental skill, experimentation, application, very hard work, peer review, huge collaborations with the university and everything else, you emerge. Now, it hasn't always been that way, but it's been moving in that way for a long time, going back to several 300-400 years, and was very well perfected as we moved in the 20th century, for good or for ill. And he was one of those people. But it was – so that's one component. But that's not enough to go Shakespearean. He needed something else, some other component that would bring him down. And that component was the naivete of the pure scientist. Right? Because the pure scientist lives within the boundaries of the field that they are mastering. And everything else is sort of outside, and they don't really have to pay much attention to it. They don't want to. It's very distracting, believe me. Pure science is not easy. And so, like many pure scientists, he believed that if the integrity of information was so important to him in the work that he did, that it must be as important to other people in the work that they did in politics, right, and in other fields of endeavor. But even that was not enough. Bring down the great Dr. McDonald. It was his time. His trajectory passed right through the 50s. The 50s was the decade, really from 47 on to 1958, of another America that you and I may never, ever see again. A country that had had its flaws and its transgressions, but it emerged finally in the 20th century as a great power with a great political structure and a very solid middle-class moral base that took on some of the greatest challenges that any country has ever seen and prevailed, the last one being World War II, of which few disagree, needed to be conducted. And we came out of that war with a sense of purpose, a sense of accomplishment, sense of positiveness that was quite extraordinary. It was the very beginning of a new era. There was a transition between that war and the Cold War. It took not just a few, but about 10 years to finally get the traction that it eventually would get. And in that gap, people, I think, felt pretty good about themselves. And James McDonald was one of them. And so when he took on the UFO issue and started to get into it deeper and deeper and deeper, and it got more and more difficult and more troubling, whatever happened, he could not allow himself to believe that his government would dare to lie about something that important to men of his integrity or to the people in general. He would not accept it. And he continued in that vein until virtually the very end, when at the end he finally realized that he had been betrayed. And the government had not only lied, it had subverted. Bob Wood actually followed that whole thing, but from a different perspective. Bob was working inside a government contractor. He did not have a public face, whereas James McDonald did. Bob judiciously made choices which allowed him to continue his work and be here today to do the work he's doing now. But James McDonald was committed fully into the public sector and fully exposed. And there were two instances, well, many instances where their lives crossed, but one of them was quite significant because Robert was approached by James, and if I get this wrong, he'll correct me, but he was approached by James to be part of the 1968 hearings that were held in the Congress, the second hearings, right? The first was in 1966, promulgated by the Michigan stuff that Gerald Ford got into. Robert thought about it, consulted his firm. The decision was finally made that it was not in the best interest of either to go ahead and not much would come of it. James McDonald did, and he was part of that hearing, the last hearing that could be called a hearing on this subject since 1968. That would be 36 years.
Okay. It's now been 45 years.
Once McDonald did that, now he was really out there. And so things started happening. And to make a long story short, another hearing came along, and this hearing was on a more mundane subject. It was on the efficacy of the SST. And they wanted James to come and testify to that hearing because it was perfectly appropriate. He was an atmospheric scientist. He's studying the issue. And he also came to Robert and thought he might want to come to that hearing. Once again, Bob saw the wisdom of not doing that. James McDonald went to that hearing. And before cameras, I think I saw that hearing, and I believe there were cameras, and we are trying. In fact, I'm going to try to work with Ann. We're going to try to find the tape. But before, I believe the cameras, the American people, the audience in the Congress, and, of course, the members of the panel, he was ridiculed and demeaned. He was embarrassed. And only because I think he did not fully see it coming, and again, had this worldview, I don't think it hit him right away, what had just happened to him. If it had happened today, it would have been immediately evident.
Listen, everybody, I have the full transcript of that hearing and how he was demeaned on my website at disclosure.media. So you can read the entire thing. I have looked everywhere, and I cannot find a videotape of the 1968 congressional hearing, but the transcript is there. And Donald Rumsfeld was there that day.
And that started a series of events which ultimately led, in only a couple of years, to Dr. McDonald very carefully, meticulously getting his affairs together, going into his office and shooting himself. But he missed. Remember, I told you this was a truly Shakespearean tragedy. He didn't hit his brain. He missed the cranial area and severed his optic nerves and blinded himself. So now you have a quintessential scientist whose ability to see the world, to understand problems, to work them out and get results, not only in mainstream science, for which he was lauded around the world, but in the area of UFO issues, where he truly believed there was a scientific explanation, if simply allowed to conduct it properly, was now unable to see at all. And true to his nature, what he did then was to embark on a recovery process, give every indication that he would able to proceed. He was so well appreciated that every effort was made to allow him to continue with all of the various devices and aids and assistance that you would need if you're blind to still pursue science. And he cooperated with that so that he could get out of the hospital, or at least get to a certain point of mobility. And at the point that he had that, he again put a few affairs in order and had a taxi cab driver drive him out into the desert near Arizona. Took a walk, got under a bridge, and finished the job in 1971. And I don't know if some of you remember the great song that eventually, actually, you couldn't avoid it. It was played billions of times. We've heard it many times, called American Pie. And American Pie is famous for being the song about the day the music died. And that day, of course, was February the 3rd, 1959, when Buddy Holly and the Big Bopper and Frankie Valens, I believe, Richie Valens, rather, were killed in a plane crash. And this song was about that. And it was a powerful metaphor. I like to think that on June 13th, 1971, with suicide of James McDonald, that was the day the science died. Because that was the end of real science on this issue in the 20th century, really. I'm not saying there wasn't science after that. Of course there was, right? But the formal engagement of hard mainstream science on the issue by qualified, intentioned people who believed in their government, believed in their profession and themselves, ended there. And whatever happened after June 13, 1971, was going to be science of a different kind, because the government was getting tough at that point. Because at the same time, McDonald was being slowly driven through a series of both external and internal events. You know how life is complicated. So as things close down, things go bad in the family, and so forth and so forth. But it's all tied together. The government was infiltrating NICAP with CIA-related agents with the intention of destroying it. And that's exactly what they did. It took another 4, 5, 6 years, but ultimately NICAP was neutralized and then abandoned. McDonald wasn't a member of NICAP, but he was a chief consultant. And NICAP was the organization pursuing this issue. And ultimately, in a normal circumstance, would have eventually resolved it. That burden then passed to MUFON, which was left, and KUFOS. But Andruffel has made a pretty good case, and there's other people that have studied it, that they destroyed the organization in the interest of the American public and national security. And they did a lot of other things, and so that was kind of a demarcation. So since the 71, we had a little different playing field. I am someone who is wanting to forgive, and I've always taken that position. We're going to have to move forward. We don't have the luxury in this century, faced with issues that even the great thinkers of the early 20th century would have blanched at, in my opinion, to go back and seek out every recrimination and every abuse and this and that and try to justify in our own minds. Can't do that. So I'm willing to forgive. However, it doesn't alter the fact that I wish that James McDonald was here, because I know he would be astounded at what is now happening. Now, part two, as was advertised, this was going to be a presentation that included the statement to President-elect, which, as we know from that slide, is George W. Bush. But it should be noted that when the original thing was set up, that wasn't known, all right? So in a way, this is kind of a surprise for me, a little bit of a surprise. I had my own political feelings about how the election would go. Now, let me be very clear here. Having political feelings about how the election would go does not necessarily denote partisanship. And in fact, and I must restate this, I do it often, Paradigm Research Group is a nonpartisan operation, and the politics of disclosure and exopolitics is nonpartisan activism. It cannot be any other way. Who I voted for is irrelevant. The fact that I'm a registered independent, I think, though, is important to know. Right? It's simply not an option to pursue this from the point of view that we need disclosure for the Democrats, right? The Republicans can go get their information somewhere else, right? Deal with it as they see fit, or vice versa. Now, this is a Republican thing. Clearly, these aliens, they seem to be physically responsible. They seem to have excellent command of technology. They hang together well. Obviously, Republicans, and that's why they're here. No, I'm sorry. It's not that way. In fact, it gets worse, folks. They're not even here just because of the Americans, all right? Even though we do make up a damn fine, let me get the number here, 5%. Of the population of the planet. They're actually engaging us all, for better or for worse. It is a nonpartisan issue. In fact, it's bigger than that. It's a transcendent issue. And so you have to pursue this that way. That doesn't mean that you can't divorce yourself from politics. I don't. But I invite you not to assume that because I say something that makes you wince a little bit, because you think maybe I'm dissing your guy, that I'm partisan in respect to this issue. I'm not. Now, having said that, I had a problem. Going into the election, I've talked about this on a number of shows, I had disclosure issues sort of down politically to these options. I saw two primary possibilities. I thought that if President Bush's prospects for second term were in serious doubt, that the Republicans might decide to do a disclosure event in order to ensure second term and to capture the legacy, right? Because I didn't feel that that a cover-up could last another 4 years, particularly under a progressive liberal from Massachusetts, and given everything else that's going on. Then the second part of that was that if Kerry won, that the Democrats, having gotten in power, would have an interesting option, because if they moved quickly to disclose, then the legacy of this would be entirely theirs. They would be the disclosure party. Kerry would be disclosure president, the great truth giver. Statues would be raised. Elementary schools would be named. And for a long time to come, administration would be analyzed and discussed with great reverence and attention. On the other hand, if they sat on their hands for 3 years, the cover-up becomes their cover-up. Same as the previous 11 administrations, right? So they had an interesting opportunity that they might take, given that people are coming out of the government, military, astronaut corps, NASA, pilots, generals, admirals, captains, and saying, yeah, there's ETs. Saw this, saw that, did this, had this document. At some point, that's going to add up, and somebody at NBC is going to go, whoa, Pulitzer Prize, and it's over, right? Well, that's not what happened. What happened is that President Bush won re-election. And so I didn't do anything until the election was done. And I was on travel on the road, so I had to do some things. I was at New Fox and took a couple days and played a little Hold'em poker, you know, whatever you need to do to relax. And I sat down to write my letter to the president, current president-elect, president of the United States. And I tried to do it, and I couldn't do it. Now, why? Yeah, obviously you want to know why. Not only because I said I was going to present it, so why didn't you do it? The letter like this, and I've done several before, the letter like this is essentially an attempt to take what has happened and find in there the gaps, the opportunities, the potential, the issues that you could address to that person and say, this is why you should do this. But when I considered the 4 years that had gone by, when I considered the previous term, and I looked at it, and I knew a lot about it, I couldn't find the cracks. I couldn't find the leverage, the angle. It was like the guy running down trying to get the angle on the halfback going around the end, and you can't get the angle. There's just no way you can make the tackle. And so I tried it again. I tried it. I couldn't do it. Now, is this a terrible criticism? Actually, no. It simply reflects the fact, when you look at the administration's posture, what they did, how they handled the issues, and then you say, gee, you need to disclose, you're thinking, this question isn't going anywhere. This letter can go nowhere. Why write this letter? Right? Now, a lot of this is circumstantial, understand. Things have happened. Buildings have fallen. Planes have crashed. People have died. A lot of things have happened. So this isn't simply a matter of a person, right? It's a matter of history. And that's something we forget. We read about history. We read about Carthaginians, and we read about the Romans. We read about the Moguls. And all this. History, Alexander chomping on through, right? Capturing most of the world. Got a movie out on that, Val Kilmer. But we never view ourselves in the middle of history now, do we? We don't imagine ourselves being in front of the advancing army of Alexander and going, wow, what a great time to be alive. I just need to get out of the way of this army. Right? We don't imagine ourselves maybe living two or three blocks down from the facilities in Philadelphia where the debates were going on with respect to the Constitution. We don't think about that. Or maybe even being a close friend of one of the signers. We don't see ourselves as drafted into the early days of the Civil War, one side or the other, and taking up arms. We don't see ourselves in history. We see history on television. We don't live it. But the fact is, you're living it big time. And that mental adjustment is necessary. It's really happening to us in an extremely high level. And so years from now, people are going to be looking back over history, and they're going to see huge stretches of massive boredom, right? Reality television will take up a small portion of that. And then they'll see what's happening here, and they'll be going, whoa, That was something else. They were there. And in fact, many of the people in this room and other conferences you will attend are going to be talked about in great detail. I promise you that. So I said, okay, I've got that letter. I'm supposed to have an open letter to the president. I don't have a letter. This could result in serious disruption, the tossing of dinner rolls, other complaints. And we don't want that. So I said, what can I do? And then it came to me. It hit me right in a kisser, like that pie that just missed Ann Coulter a couple of weeks. 4 years ago, I wrote another open letter to the president, which has been published in a number of venues, including on my website. And I went back and looked at it, and I said, that's interesting. Let me just check. Is anybody – this is the open letter to George Bush, January 1, 2001. How many of y'all had actually read that? I think maybe a couple. Not too many. Okay, good, good, good. So there you go. Something that you haven't – I don't know why you haven't been to my website. It's a perfectly fine website. It's got a catchy address, paradigmclock.com. Go there. Check it out. No pop-ups, and you won't get any spam. What I'm going to do now is read to you the letter that I wrote. And this, trust me, I can prove it 8 ways to Sunday. This letter was written January 1st, 2001 to the elected President Bush. And I may do a few asides on it. Then let's think about it a little bit. Open letter to the President-elect. I open with two quotes. The first quote comes from an extremely important passage in the Old Testament, which most of you have talked about or heard about at one time or another, is Ezekiel 1:4. And in there is this line that says, "Then I looked, and behold, a whirlwind was coming out of the north, a great cloud with raging fire engulfing itself, and brightness was all around it, and radiating out of its midst like the colors of amber out of the midst of the fire. I looked, and behold, a whirlwind was coming." George Bush, in his inaugural address, made a reference which nobody really understands why he did it. It was commented on very briefly, and we moved on because there was a country to run, and I understand that. And the reference he made in the inaugural was, "And an angel still rides in the whirlwind and directs this storm." Who is the angel? What is the storm? I didn't know. I needed to put that in there. And then I wrote this to the president 4 years ago. "Mr. President, you are elected by one of the narrowest popular vote margins in the history of the nation. After hundreds of millions of dollars in campaign expenditures, the Senate is now in the remarkable status of a 50-50 party split, and the Republican majority in the House has been reduced so by the merest virtue of the vice presidential tiebreaker, the country has chosen unified government for only the fourth time since 1969. Of equal importance, you campaigned as a uniter, not a divider. You said you would end the bickering and the gridlock. This is a laudatory goal for which the American public has expressed a clear desire. Your timing is excellent, and there is an unprecedented need for bipartisanship in Washington." That need, and this is where I get a little bit partisan, to me, my issue. "The executive and the legislative branches of the United States government must delay no longer the direct engagement of the 50 years suppression of the truth surrounding the presence of extraterrestrials in our world." "The long-term implications to the nation of social security integrity, prescription drug benefits, and gun policy may be of importance. The resolution of the UFOET cover-up and the reform of the military-industrial complex is of monumental importance. Only a fully bipartisan effort can address. It is notable that during your campaign, a gentleman by the name of Charles Huffer asked if you would, as president, get out the truth concerning UFOs. You answered that you would do so. It is worth mentioning there are tens of millions of American citizens eager to see you keep that promise. As you consider your course of action toward this issue, permit the expression of some particular concerns. There is ample evidence the last two Democratic presidents, Carter and Clinton, were personally interested in the UFOET question. Clinton interest was partially fueled by a substantial initiative funded by a renowned philanthropist and conservationist, Lawrence Rockefeller. Both presidents made investigatory overtures, but were rebuffed with extreme prejudice by their agency heads. Further, there is a developing sense the military leadership in the nation has a favorite, quote-unquote, party, Republican Party. During the campaign, you stood on the dais with retired generals Colin Powell and Norman Schwarzkopf. From the beginning of the Clinton administration, the contempt of the military for the sitting president, Clinton, was severe enough to require disciplinary action. Within the UFO ET research community, there is a growing consensus. Some presidents are permitted full briefings on the UFO ET subject, and others are not. And this policy has for some time been split along party lines. In the 11 years since the symbolic end to the Cold War, the dismantlement of the Berlin Wall, the United States has executed several successful displays of overwhelming military power, dramatically expanded its economic influence, and extended its strategic alliances. Inexplicably, this has not resulted in optimism for future peace and stability. Rather, the incoming administration, the armed services, and the intelligence agencies have fostered a foreboding sense of an incipient, paranoia-driven militarism. During your campaign, there was a repeated reference to dissatisfaction with the nation's role in peacekeeping, vis-a-vis a renewed emphasis on war-making. You selected a former Secretary of Defense as Vice President for the first time in history. You selected a former Secretary of Defense as the new Secretary of Defense for the first time in history. You selected a former Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff as Secretary of State for the first time in history. Major new spending, massive new war technologies, and aggressive new postures appear to be in the offing. And embedded in this process is the militarization of space, which has been advancing with scant comment by the Congress and meager awareness amongst the public. In the five decades following the end of World War II, the nation turned itself upside down. A reasonable interpretation of the Constitution, Declaration of Independence, and other founding documents show the United States was to be a country in which the government would operate in the open on behalf of a private citizen. The opposite is now the status quo. The government is immersed in a cult of secrecy, drowning in classified documents, programs, and personnel. It operates underground facilities, controls vast classified military intelligence reservations, stonewalls every investigative or accusatory assault on its actions by journalists, veterans, congressional members, hides its illegal activities behind the National Security Act whenever it wishes, conducts illegal experiments on civilian and military persons, subverts constitutionally protected research and investigations by private citizens, conducts illegal surveillance of ever-increasing sophistication both home and abroad in support of an ever-increasing list of crimes headed by a failed war on drugs, criminalizing millions, and builds a national identifier out of the Social Security registration number and uses that ID to create credit, medical, employment, and personal activity profiles of every citizen within an electronic framework riddled with holes and abuse. In contrast, the private citizen's life has been splayed open like an autopsied corpse, the public citizen's life placed under a microscope to be mined by pundits and stand-up comedians for new material in the service of ridicule. These are ominous trends which the UFO ET research activist community know to be connected. Returning to the core issue, while there is obviously a firmament of questions that could be raised regarding the extraterrestrial presence, these are the three primary political decisions to make: whether to hold a disclosure event or continue the cover-up, how comprehensive and truthful the initial information disclosed will be, and whether to create a military hostile posture toward the extraterrestrials acknowledged in this disclosure event. For the past 10 years, a growing political movement has targeted the politics of UFOs disclosure, exopolitics. All levels of the media have received extensive materials on the subject. Former members of the U.S. military, former astronauts, and many other government employees have been speaking privately and publicly in unambiguous terms regarding extraterrestrial presence and a government cover-up. Significant political events targeting the UFO ET cover-up are being scheduled for the first year of your administration. I refer you to the May 9th press conference, 2001. A growing portfolio of I'm speaking out now. on the side. A growing portfolio of documentaries will highlight the facts. Investigative journalists are now targeting the political realities, and articles are working their way toward the top media outlets. Other nations, such as France and Mexico, are moving to assert their hegemony in this matter. Pressure on the U.S. government to end the cover-up is only going to increase during your administration, second term. Yet there will be advisors who will encourage you to disregard this growing movement and play the cover-up game out until such time as certain non-elected military intelligence personnel give you the green light to proceed, if ever. You will be tempted to take this advice. Don't. Each day, the UFOET cover-up continues, and each new revelation of abuse of power by this or that government agency further erodes the fundamental trust the American people hold in their government, and benchmarks for trust in government are at all-time lows. If you truly wish to unite the country and begin a new era of cooperation, you must engage an issue of transcendent importance. That issue is at hand. So went the letter to the President, January 1, 2001. Now, January, February, March, April, May, 4.5 months later, the National Press Club press conference, conducted by the Disclosure Project, was presented. Tape of 100 witness testimonies was consolidated to a four-hour tape provided to all of the press, of which there were 117 present, including 17 camera crews. A number of media were very interested. I personally, through a contact at ABC, sent a tape directly to Ted Koppel. They responded immediately with a request to interview six of the witnesses. International press was galvanized. Yes, I personally tried to discourage the inclusion of the militarization of space and energy via secluded technologies from that conference. I thought it was a tactical error. There was some upset. It was not my conference. It was not my show. They proceeded. But the point is, it was a major conference. They had the right to hold it as they saw fit, and they held it. And I don't recall anybody else holding one. Right? So, the letter seems to be somewhat predictive here. But as we know, exactly 4 months later, a new era began on September 11th. And history took a turn. Right? You know what I'm talking about. You know what I'm talking about when history takes a turn. You know what it feels like to take a wrong turn, right? It's uncomfortable. Cruising along, it's maybe 10 o'clock at night, and you're trying to get to a McDonald's or something, take the wrong turn. The next thing you know, you're out in the woods, you don't know where you are, you don't feel uncomfortable. Well, let me tell you, that's nothing compared to when history takes a wrong turn. And in the space of 3 months, you find yourself so deep in the woods, you have no idea whether you, your countrymen, or your nation will ever come back. This is not a partisan statement. It happens to all nations. It's happened to them all. And it's not fun, but that's the way it is. History is interesting that way. Again, it's like waking up one day and suddenly realizing that Alexander's army, which was heading straight, you know, up the Euphrates, decided to take a left turn, and now they're heading right for your house. And you're going, wow, that's bad, right? And you feel vulnerable, and you feel uncertain. And the one thing you feel is that everything else you're doing has got to be put on the back burner, and you got to get out of the way of this of history as it advances upon you. Know pretty much what's happened in the last 4 years. Everything I believe in this letter was appropriate, and I believe everything in this letter still holds to be true, perhaps more than ever, and I will not belabor it. I will try to say it as simply as I can, and this is a very controversial statement I'm about to make, and I would love to debate it with you, but unfortunately I have an engagement afterwards, but I'm going to tell you right now. It is my belief, right? So my belief, my opinion. I can't prove this. It's not one of those things you can prove. Haven't got any material evidence on this one. This is pure, unadulterated, intellectual opinion backed up by not one iota of physical evidence. It is my opinion that all of the issues in the world today, as awkward as they are, from the fact that Bangladesh always seems to flood every time there's a bad storm, from the fact that the Middle East seems to be in a 15,000-year hate cycle that it just can't get out of. The fact that Africa has a genocide about once every 4 months. The fact that there are tyrants out there that like to brutalize their people, right? The fact that there's a hole in the ozone. The fact that the waters are rising around certain parts of the world. The fact that we can't find enough landfills anymore. The fact that the euro is going up against the dollar, and 10,000 other things, which I know we need to pay attention to, and I certainly want all the people we elect to do that, though frankly, I don't know what they're doing, are all secondary to this issue, period, okay? And when somebody says to me, as soon as we solve the Middle East problem, as soon as we can feed everybody, as soon as we can build some levees around Bangladesh, as soon as we get all this tidied up, then we're going to turn to this UFO thing and work it out. No way, okay? And that's not because I want it that way. The extraterrestrials want it that way. They showed up. They stay up there. They allow themselves to be seen. They interfere with our weapon systems. They're here. They mean business, whatever that business is. And this idea will just tidy up things and we'll deal with it. But it's worse than that because, I say it's not worse than that, it is in fact more subtle than it. I think you can make a case that we have sort of reached that spot due to any number of factors you wish to calculate, where being able to address the issues of this planet requires us to have a little more information, okay? In other words, if you're trying to deal with a sewer system in Venice, you know, in the 13th century, you really don't need to know, you know, what's going on in, the southern part of Japan. You don't need to know a lot of things. Now we need to know so much more, all right, as we try to decide who are we? Do we really want to live amongst ourselves in peace? Do we really want to get along? Maybe road rage is a good thing. We're trying to think about a lot of things like that. And we're having to make incredibly difficult decisions that increasingly surpass our educational skills. I took 6 years to get through college, so it's way over my educational skills. So what other information could maybe assist us in assessing our problems in the context of the globe, the spaceship Earth? Okay. That Barbara Ward told us so eloquently about in the late 50s, folks. I think she got a Pulitzer for that. How about the fact that the galaxy is loaded with intelligent life, all right? There's people out there listening to FM, AM radio stations, having parties and everything else light years away. How about the fact that they're coming and going? How about the fact that we're not alone? How about the fact that there's technology beyond ours that may be available and 1,000 other things? How about the fact that the real reality of the universe is it's not just filled with space and occasional rocks. In fact, it's loaded with life. The evidence is absolutely incontrovertible. Thus puts us in the context of a galactic civilization. Gee, that would be nice to know, right? Don't you think that would be nice to know? As you decide, do I want the world order or don't want the world order? Should I join the Bilderbergs and not join the Bilderbergs? Should I go to Bohemian Grove or should I just sneak in? Should I bring a bathing suit or go, you know, on natural? Whatever you're trying to calculate here, you ought to know that there's a civilization out there and you're part of it, for better or for good. Maybe they're hostile. You ought to know that, right? Look, if you got 100 people coming over for Sunday dinner and in fact they're all heavily armed, but nobody neglects to tell you that, that's not good. Right? So, if that's the case, and if I'm right, I may be wrong, then before we too far down that roadmap to peace, before we spend another 4,000 hours debating Rush Limbaugh over the global warming issue, before we do pretty much anything else, we need to at least acknowledge this truth, which has been well established, and fit that into the picture, and then we'll have a much bigger amount of the puzzle to work with. And perhaps the solutions will come a little easier. I don't think that's unreasonable, all right? And unless somebody can make a case that a global ignorance, where probably somewhere between 5 and 5.9 billion people, maybe even more, don't have firsthand formal acknowledged understanding of this issue, Not just people that are going, yeah, I know it's true. I'm talking about formal, right, where you're inside, you're in the loop, 5.95, whatever, are in that, and just a few know what's going on. Unless somebody can make a case, well, that's good, all right, that's a good thing. In other words, we got 6 billion people. We'll keep 99.9% of them utterly in the dark on this, and we'll have 0.11% that knows what's going on, and that will work out very well for us, OK? Okay? That's like saying, look, I got a new idea. From now on, let's have a new policy. Only 1% of the people on the highways will actually know how to drive. The rest will simply, we'll make sure they never even see a car before they're 19. Then we'll just suddenly put them in a car and tell them, go drive, okay? It'll work out. I know it will. It'll make life more exciting. All right. I think I've made my point here with respect to that. So forgive me for not giving you that. I gave you the old letter, four-year-old letter, which I like very much, and I will keep up for as long as I can. Now, the next thing I want to do before I get to the last part is try to tell you what Paradigm Research wants to do in lieu of the situation that exists. And there's two things that are going on. One, I'm traveling the country, try to raise money so the Paradigm Research can go to the next group, next level, right, and start doing more things better, not just the ex-conflict. And there's potential breakthroughs there. The second thing is that after looking at the political dynamics that we're faced with, there are two things going on that are there's one thing going on I'll tell you about, and then there's one primary tactic I'll tell you about, and then I'll go to the last section. The one thing that's going on is that I have been getting indications, not only from my own personal experience, but from others, that there is movement inside the Beltway. Something is happening, all right? Meeting calls, I'm getting invited to certain meetings, certain individuals are coming out we hadn't expected, getting a little different tone from somebody. There's just a sense, and I asked other people about this, do you sense something going? They say they sense something going on, all right? That's a good thing. It is not impossible. In fact, there's still a reasonable probability that George Bush is going to be the disclosure president. And the reason for that is not too hard to figure out. Of course, the issue is, could they do it before, quote, they get through the rest of the stuff? I can make a case they need to mitigate the rest of the stuff. But in any event, the one thing that has changed now, as of 4 years ago when I wrote this other letter, is that George Bush came in the first time in an extraordinary election with no mandate at all. Without the popular vote, and in totally contested life. We all know that. Won't relive that, okay? His father, of course, is the quintessential military intelligence complex man with all the right connections, very positive. He had the strong Vice President Cheney connected back to his father and Reagan, but he didn't have the mandate. Well, his father's still there. Reagan's passed on, but the legacy's still there. Now he has the mandate, a massive turnout, 114 million, and has a 3 million, 4 million vote margin. 52% mandate. So in a sense, that makes it easier, if you're thinking the way I'm thinking, for them to make the maneuver. The disclosure president will be one of the great historic figures of all time. And the issues that will immediately arise will be very powerful. And so it's a great risk to take that maneuver and have those issues come out when the president is in such a vulnerable position from the standpoint of the electorate. That's not unreasonable, right? Now they don't have that. They have a strong position, both the House, the Senate, and the President. And so they may act. And if they do, then President Bush will be the disclosure president. And that's fine with me. And we will start to get to the truth. His legacy will be assured, right? And the Democrats can sit back and wonder, what opportunities did they lose? What opportunities were missed? But that's the way it is, you know? You seize history or you don't. History doesn't care. It moves on with or without you. If you want to take a dalliance with an intern, fine, but understand, it's like one of those 800-yard drives. It's a small mistake when you hit it, but by the time it lands down the end of the golf course, it's 800 yards into the woods, and you can't find the ball anymore, no pun intended. Now, I'm going to move now to the last part of our keynote. I want to get personal for a second. Not that I haven't been personal. Want to get more personal. And one of the reasons I want to do this is because I think that one of the roles that I have, one of the mandates that I have, mission statements that I have, which is needed, is to find a way to emotionally connect people to this issue. It's absolutely essential. You cannot move forward politically in activism or pretty much any other aspects of politics without emotional connection. You can't do it. If in the beginning of the civil rights the closing era of the civil rights movement in, say, the late 50s, you know, they went to a lot of activists and students in the North and whatever, and they said, look, we need to all get the bus. We need to, you know, put on our white shirts and ties, and we need to head on down to the South there and do a lot of hard work so that we can increase the percentage of blacks and other ethnics who were vote from 11.7 to 19.8. And if we can get it to 19.8, we're getting on the bus and we're coming home, right? Still statistical improvement. That's what we're trying to do. That's all. You couldn't get them. Not going to go. Not going to happen. You don't take those kind of risks, and you don't get involved in that kind of stuff unless you've got a real emotional connection to it. That emotional connection is still maturing in this movement, which is still maturing itself. So I think it's one of the things that I'm trying to do when I can. And I want to do that tonight by talking about two people. I've been in the field now, as of January of next year, will be 10 years. Not a long time, a decade. It's been fun. It's been great. Had many, many good times, but 10 years seems long when the goal keeps moving. You know what I'm talking about? And so, but I've met some extraordinary people. I mean, no matter what happens, right? If I don't see the end of this, okay. I've met people I couldn't have imagined, because I got to tell you, the first 45 years of my life was boring as hell. All right? I mean, it was bad. So I've made up for that. I've met a lot of interesting people, and I want to tell you about two of them tonight. Are we okay? You all with me here? You're not starting to nod off of me. Are you okay? Okay. Huh? No, I'm okay. Well, let me have just a little. Just one. Drying out. By the way, I won $1,000 last night at Let It Ride. 4 deuces. Not ostentatious, but it does the job. It's my style. Talk about two people, and before I talk about the first person, I want to kind of mention something. You know, there's a phrase that has been around for pretty much the last 20 years, and all of you have heard it, particularly you all have heard it, and it says there are no coincidences, right? There are no coincidences. And the guy that made the most money off of that phrase is James Redfield with Celestine Prophecy and the rest of the series of books, and then he retired and went to the Caribbean. I think he bought an island there, as a matter of fact. And you know, it's funny. When I was a kid, when I was a young man, I was a science guy, physics major. And intellectually, when I was a young man, this idea of there are no coincidences made total sense. Of course not. Cause and effect. Everything has a cause which provides an effect. And since everything has a cause and effect, nothing can be a coincidence, right? Simple. No problem. Shut down. No sweat. I was 23. I was righteous. Now, emotionally, though, my attitude about coincidences was, nah. There's some things that happened that clearly they're just totally off the wall. No way this is a coincidence. Can't happen. It's just emotionally doesn't feel right. Then 30 years go by and I'm a middle-aged man. Not an elderly man. I'm a middle-aged man. And it's reversed. Logically, I think there are coincidences, because after you look at quantum mechanics and field theory and non-locality and a host of other issues, you know, Heisenberg uncertainty principle, you start to realize, wow, there's a whole lot of accidental stuff going on here. So there could be all kinds of coincidences. But emotionally, I had reverse course too. Emotionally, I'm going, nah, there's this connected thing going on here. You know what I'm saying? It's like you go over here and you do that, and then you get an audit from the IRS over here. And I'm telling you, man, it's all connected, right? So I've reversed course. That's where I'm going right now. I don't know where it all is. But there are no coincidences, which brings me to Dr. John Mack. And I'm going to have to read a little of this, too, because this might be tough to get through. It wouldn't be appropriate for me to say that I was a friend of Dr. Mack, who, by the way, as I think you all know, was hit by a truck in London and died recently in perfect health, probably 10, 15 years ahead of him. An acquaintance, perhaps. We had met on a few occasions and spoke on a few occasions. It would be a considerable hubris to say a common interest in extraterrestrial-related phenomena made us colleagues. John Mack was a giant of the 20th century, whose work will soon, though not soon enough, be vindicated. I was a repressed activist without portfolio, who had misplaced the first half of his life and was seeking a role and a purpose for the last half. But John Mack would influence me as no other person had ever done. In 1995, while re-examining my long but not pursued interest in the UFO question, I read Abduction, Human Encounters with Aliens. That such a distinguished academic would dare to engage the abduction issue left a considerable impression. It was one of many indications that the study of extraterrestrial-related phenomena had risen to a new level. And this in no way diminishes the work of Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs and the many others. But Mack's 45-year relationship with Harvard had implications for disclosure, which were quite considerable, and combined with other indicators seemed to point toward a resolution to this issue. And so it was in the late fall of 1995, from California, I approached the Program for Extraordinary Experience Research, PEER, in Cambridge, with a request to volunteer as a development assistant. PEER was part of the Center for Psychology and Social Change, founded in 1982 by Dr. Mack and his colleagues. Then executive Karen Wesolowski, who handled these matters, generously accepted my offer. I arrived in Cambridge January 26, 1996, in the middle of one of the worst winters in decades. Cleared snow was piled higher than the buses. Dr. Mack was out of town. This was, again, late January of 1996. So a week to settle in would be followed by an introduction when he returned in early February. John Mack had just passed through two of the most difficult years of his professional life. It began when a woman approached him at a UFO conference and told him she was very interested in his work and wanted assistance in exploring her abduction experiences. She would eventually undergo several hypnosis sessions and shortly thereafter approach Time magazine with the story of how she had faked her experience in order to expose Dr. Mack's research methodology and UFO cult. The April 25, 1994 Time article, triggered by her scoop, led to a 14-month investigation by Harvard that put Dr. Mack through the ringer and did not end until the fall of 95, when Harvard issued a report which chose not to censure him and reaffirm Dr. Mack's academic freedom to study what he wishes and to state his opinions without impediment, unquote. Behind the scenes, though, the woman continued to create disruption for Dr. Mack, including turning up at the June 1994 meeting of PSYCOP, the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal, which had invited Mack to present. John estimated the cost of his Harvard investigation defense to be in excess of $250,000. During the next year, 1995, the respected PBS program NOVA produced a documentary titled Kidnapped by UFOs, featuring Dr. Mack, Bud Hopkins, among others. Early in February 1996, NOVA delivered to the office of PEER a pre-broadcast copy of the documentary as a courtesy. On the morning of his return to Cambridge, John reviewed the finished documentary for the first time. He quickly learned that NOVA had turned the documentary into a hit piece. One NOVA producer resigned when the PBS suits demanded the documentary take this direction. Along with poor science and bad editing, NOVA had given over a full segment to the sting operation by the woman who had plagued Mack's work for 2 years and nearly cost him his tenure. Her name was Donna Rice Bassett. Right after viewing the documentary, Dr. Mack joined Karen Wesolowski and me in the meeting room. Karen made the introduction. John, this gentleman has come all the way from California to help us and is very interested in your work. Please meet Stephen Bassett. In early 2004, I invited John to speak at the April X conference. His schedule was quite full, and as expected, he declined, and through an intermediary, he did add that John was a bit uncomfortable with my confrontational approach. This did not offend. I'm a political activist. Confrontation, nonviolent, of course, is an indispensable tool. The government is enormously powerful and yields its secrets and its power with great reluctance, and time is running out. There are many paths. But upon reading the reply, I immediately recall that February day in 1996 when we met for the first time. Later that afternoon in the reception area of Pier, John was sitting on the sofa contemplating the Nova documentary, soon to be aired nationally. And I heard him mutter to himself, "The fascists are coming to get me." Inside the gentle professor was an activist who wanted a better world, based on understanding and compassion. I held out hope that John would agree to present at X-Conference 2005. It would have been a great honor. Are there no coincidences? Certainly the synchronicity of that February day has remained with me. In May of that year, sitting in my office in Cambridge and contemplating my departure from Pier, my course for the rest, the next 8 years, simply fell right into my lap, fully formed. I soon left for Washington in July to engage the politics of UFOs, meaning the politics of disclosure, meaning exopolitics, and the work continues. And the work is difficult, which is why one looks for the odd hook here and there upon which to hang their motivations. One I found was this. A woman who married a gentleman with the same name as mine tried to ruin a great man and demean his work. I'm going to help end the truth embargo, which prevents the vindication of his work. And it will be a pleasure. Now, I want to tell you about another person that I cross paths with. His name is Peter Morgenstern Clarin. In 2002, during one of the hottest summers on record, 30 volunteers.
All right, everybody. There's 11 minutes left, and to have you start this tearjerker story and not get to hear the end just isn't fair. We're going to have to end pretty soon, so I'm going to play you out with a song. I wish you and your family and your friends the greatest abundance in 2015. I thank you for your friendship. I thank you for your contributions and your work and emotional support to end the truth embargo. I'm deeply grateful. I think about each and every one of you every single day, and I pray for an abundance of wealth, health, wisdom, in your lives every single day. God bless. Have fun tonight. And see you in the next year. It will be our best ever.